Hello and welcome to Mind in Mind. My name is Jane O'Rourke. I'm a child, adolescent and family psychotherapist and the founder of Mind in Mind. Mind in Mind is a new website featuring interviews with the world's leading clinicians working in child mental health, sharing what they know helps children. On October the 1st, to officially launch Mind in Mind, we gathered a group of clinicians who between them have had an enormous influence on child psychotherapy and the children and families they've dedicated their lives to helping. The driving force of Mind in Mind has been to capture the voices of the founding greats of child psychotherapy. And you can hear many of them here, gathered together in discussion about what best helps deprived and traumatised children. Key highlights include our guest star of the evening, Gianna Williams, whose theory, double deprivation, has become an important concept in understanding deprived children. And Ricky Emanuel joined her to discuss how organisations that are supposed to be helping deprived children can sometimes actually further deprive them, leading to triple deprivation, a concept developed by his late wife, Louise Emanuel. And Grey Music illuminated our understanding of trauma with a psychoanalytic and neurobiological lens. Stephen Seligman talked about the importance of parent-infant work, and Selma Freiberg, with whom he worked. Jean McGanier shared with us the magic of teaching child observation to parents. And there were valuable contributions from other child psychotherapy greats, Lydia Tischler, Iska Wittenberg, and Monica Laniardo. So sit back and enjoy the wisdom that flows from these luminaries in child psychotherapy about what best helps deprived and traumatised children.
It's very nice of you to join us all. Thank you so much. And welcome to our event to officially launch Mind in Mind. I'm Jane O'Rourke. I'm a child, adolescent and family psychotherapist, and I'm the founder of Mind in Mind. It was just going to be a modest launch this evening, but so many of you signed up. We're really blown away by the number of people who've expressed interest and wanted to join the launch this evening. I think it's quite appropriate. We've got babies crying outside. I don't know whether you can hear it, but there's a very loud, noisy baby crying outside. So if this wasn't how we wanted to do to launch Mind in Mind, it's taken a couple of years or more actually for it to come to fruition. But we have all had to adjust and accommodate in how we work therapeutically and even how we do launches. But of course, coming together in this way does provide an opportunity for us to learn from some of the wisest and most experienced minds in child psychotherapy. And I'm talking in particular about our star guest this evening, Gianna Palacca-Williams. She'll be in conversation with other child psychotherapy luminaries, Grey Music, Stephen Seligman, Ricky Emanuel, and they'll be talking about how deprived children can best be understood and helped. And I'm welcoming your contributions this evening from our audience. We'll talk through about how we're going to do that in the chat function. Grey Music is going to be in charge of doing that for us. So I thought I'd share a plan with you for this evening so you know what we're going to be doing. We're here until 7:30. So let me go to screen share. So this is the plan for this evening. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a tour of Mind in Mind and what's on there, just to give you a bit of an idea, and also some background as to how it came about and what our aims and vision are for Mind in Mind. And also, I'm going to, after that, going to introduce you to the advisory board of Mind in Mind, Grey Music, Stephen Seligman, Laura May Brown, and Shivani Lamba. And then we'll be getting straight on to Gianna Williams. The focus of the discussion tonight is about child deprivation. And so Gianna's going to be in conversation with me, and then Ricky Emanuel. Some of you might know Ricky and his wife, late wife, Louise Emanuel. Wrote a really important paper sort of advancing some of the thinking or sort of evolving some of the thinking that Gianna Williams talked about in double deprivation. She came up with the concept of triple deprivation. So we're going to be hearing from Ricky about that. And then having some input from Stephen Seligman from the States. Thank you for joining us this evening, Stephen. Really appreciate it. And Grey Music. And then we'll be coming to some questions and reflections from you, our audience. It'd be wonderful to hear from you. And then lastly, we'd really like your input as to the future direction of Mind in Mind, sharing your ideas about the future therapeutic work with children and how we at Mind in Mind can be most effectively be a part of it to help you and support you in your work with children and families. So that's the plan for this evening. I thought maybe it's probably worth giving a little bit of background as to how Mind in Mind came about. You might be wondering, where's this come from and why has it come about? So before I trained as a child psychotherapist at the Telstock, I used to work on Radio 4. I was a producer there. And I've always been fascinated by the power of the media in shaping public thinking. And we all know how it can be used positively and negatively. I spent a few years in Bosnia as a on secondment with NATO when I was working on Radio 4 to help train journalists who'd been really manipulated by the media to sort of help in different causes. So with the Serbs and with the Bosnians, Muslims and the Croats, and they'd all been sort of co-opted. So the power of the media is really, really can be very, very influential, both positively and negatively. And we know that there are notable names in psychiatry who've utilised the media in a really positive way to disseminate their thinking. I remember coming across some old recordings of Donald Winnicott's lectures on Radio 4 in the 1950s when I was working on Woman's Hour, producing Woman's Hour. And really being enlightened by his concept that that mothers don't need to be perfect. And I think it came as a great relief to women then, and it continues to be a great relief to mothers, I think, when they hear about that. And some of you may remember the wonderful psychiatrist, Professor Anthony Clare, who I worked with producing All in the Mind on Radio 4. And he really made the workings of the mind much less mysterious, I think, for millions of people at a time when people didn't talk about the workings of the mind quite so much as they do now. So what's this got to do with Mind in Mind, you might ask? Well, one of the most important things when I began training at the Tavistock that I learned was that every problem that I came across in a case could be thought about. And I found that it was especially helpful if you have a wise and experienced mind to think with you. And I've been especially lucky in the supervision that I've had in supervising my clinical cases. And boy, do we need wise minds right now. Child mental health, I don't need to tell you, has been on a downward spiral even before the pandemic. And many people working with children therapeutically are feeling really burnt out by the overwhelm that they are experiencing because of the need that's out there. But of course, all of us, I really believe, would not be able to work in the way that we do with severely deprived children if it wasn't for the thinking we get in supervision and the theories that we've learned to help our understanding of children. And it's this thinking I would really like to be able to share on Mind in Mind with other people who are working therapeutically with children. Child psychotherapy, as you know, is steeped in some of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century. I'm thinking about Anna Freud, Melanie Klein, John Bowlby, his niece, Juliet Hopkins is with us this evening, Donald Winnicott, who I've just mentioned, and of course, Matty Harris from the Tavistock. They're just a few who come to mind. And we are very lucky that there are many brilliant successes of these great names who have been responsible for evolving some really important theories and concepts about child mental health, as well as establishing some of the first therapeutic services for children and young people. They've been enormously influential. But a few years ago, when I was coming to the end of my training, I realized that many of these people had never been interviewed properly. So my journey with Mind in Mind has been about capturing the voices of these most important thinkers in child psychotherapy who are alive today, so they can continue to inspire and inform child therapists around the world. My first interview was with Dilys Dawes about 2.5 years ago, I think it was. I didn't have a plan about what I was going to do really with the interview. But as I sat listening to Dilys in her amazing living room that's full of a lifetime's collection of artifacts, I realised that what she had to say about standing by the weighing scales in the James Wigg GP practice in Kentish Town in North London, and about the vital work that she has done with parent-infant work, helping young parents with small children, and about providing that early intervention, I really felt that this is something that everyone working with children really, really needs to know about. So let me share with you the website that's evolved from this sort of mission to share these voices. I'm going to come to a screen share with you. Okay, just bear with me for a second. Okay, so there we are. I think it's here. Hopefully you can see this. So this is Mind in Mind. This is the live website that the wonderful Paul Martin has put together for us. So on the front page, you can see that we've got Anne Alvarez. Graham interviewed her with me. And that interview will be going out in the next few weeks or so. So this is the homepage. We've got 5 interviews up there so far. The first one to go live is Janice, and that just went live this morning. We've got Monica Laliardos here. I mean, Monica has been so influential in our thinking about child trauma. She's spent her clinical life, in fact, I think she was about 19. Correct me if I'm wrong, Monica, but I think you're about 19 when you first started working with disadvantaged children. And her impact on shaping the thinking of how we should approach children who've been deeply traumatised has been absolutely phenomenal. And so I was really, really honoured that Monica agreed to an interview. We've got Juliet Hopkins. I think her concept about too good mothering I think is just such an important one for anyone who's working with parents. And so I was really, really pleased to get her perspective and some of the early, some of her memories of her early training and working with the likes of John Bowlby. And we've got Lydia Tischler. I think some of you might have just seen her before talking with us briefly. Lydia is phenomenal. She has used her position as a child psychotherapist. She was one of the first child psychotherapists to train, in fact. She trained at the time when Anna Freud was around. Her influence in the child psychotherapy world is enormous. And she set up child psychotherapy trainings in Eastern Europe. And she worked at the Castle Hospital and provided an intervention so that mothers and babies and families could stay together, which prevented an awful lot of children being taken into care. So I think children and families, as well as the child psychotherapy world, owe an awful lot to Lydia. And I think you'll enjoy her interview when that goes live in a few weeks' time. And then we've got the wonderful Iska Wittenberg. I'm just clicking on that so you can hear a tiny little clip. It's just a minute clip. And I say here in the introduction that she's illuminated the child psychotherapy world with her understanding about the loss of, about the impact of loss and endings. She's wonderful. And I spoke to her yesterday. She's still going strong, still working and thinking and contributing. She has been amazing. Anyway, you can hear a tiny clip, which I'm going to play to you now, about the impact and the importance of loss and endings, which of course is pertinent at this time of COVID, when so many of us have lost important people in our lives. So here's Iska.
What increasingly difficult under Hitler's regime, so that as a school child we would go one direction and be met by children that were going to Christian schools, and they would spit in our face.
And in what way do you think those early experiences has contributed to your understanding?
Of Hendrix is what you wanted really to know. Well, it only dawned on me very late in life, at about 80, that it might have to do with us having to end our relationship with Germany because of Hitler, and ending our life in Germany made me aware how important it is that endings should be thought about and how often they are not thought about. That you've got to try to prepare yourself for that. Whether it's early in life or later in life, got increasingly difficult.
So there you have it. So that's Iska. And I wanted to show you, we've also got thought pieces. These are our blogs. We've got Judith Edwards, who is here with us this evening. She's talking about bearing with not knowing, the concept of not knowing. I think it's such a really important concept for all of us working therapeutically to know more about. And she's written a beautiful blog. Let me just show you it so you can come to it and read it at your own leisure. Really lovely blog. Thank you. Thank you, Judith. And we've got our Stephen Seligman writing about curiosity and constructive skepticism in psychoanalysis. It's a really fantastic, insightful blog. And Gray Music talking about childhood obesity and a re-examination of what's really causing it. So some real depth of thinking going on already, just as Mind and Mind has launched, and a lot more to come. And for some of you who prefer podcasts to listen to rather than videos, I'm actually one of those people. I love, love, love podcasts. And it's a real rich source of information and inspiration for me. The first podcast has gone live today with Jana. So I think some of the podcast channels are yet to pick up our channel. So our feed, I should say. So it might be a few weeks before you can find Mind in Mind. But I know for sure it's on Spotify and quite a few others already. So there's Mind in Mind. I'm going to stop sharing, screen sharing. So then I can introduce the board to you. Okay, so let me just get rid of that. Come back. Okay. So there we are. All right. So having done a tour of the website, I'd like to introduce our board members. This wouldn't have been possible without them. And they've been hugely influential on me in terms of the thinking that's gone on in the creation of the website and the development of the interviews. So I want to introduce you, first of all, to Gray Music. Probably, actually, many of you won't need any introduction to Graham. He's a very well-known consultant child psychotherapist at the Tavistock Centre and an adult psychotherapist. And he's a prolific clinician and writer. And his passion for exploring the interface between developmental findings and clinical work has made him a lively and vital source of shaping of our thinking in child psychotherapy. So welcome, Graham. Thank you for helping to monitor our chat room, as well as being such an important source of support to us at Mind in Mind. I'm just wondering, what are you hoping for the website?
Well, I'm very excited by the whole concept. And part of what I quite like, and it links with Judith's blogs and Stephen's in a way, is that we don't quite know where it's going to go, but it's a hub of potential, I think, of opportunities. And I hope it will be a kind of, in a way, a place where ideas can evolve and can be developed and can be catalyzed. And we can get some of the most important traditional ideas out there. So, and the set of thinkers we've got to start with are extraordinary, but I think then we will also be able to develop and bring in bits of research and have discussions about new papers. I think it's a whole range of really interesting things, because I think it's quite vital that these ideas can get out there in a different sort of way. And as far as I can see, this is the first of its kind. And it's fantastic having you at the helm, Jane, with your media experience, because most of us are completely lost in this world. So that's really fantastic. And So I think just watch this space. It's a creative open space and we want everybody to contribute, really, whether you've got thought pieces, blogs, ideas about interviews, whole book reviews, a whole range of different things that we might be doing. So I'm very excited. Thanks.
Thanks, Graham. And I'm also very pleased to have Stephen Seligman join us from the States this evening. It's your afternoon, isn't it, Stephen, I think, still. Stephen is clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, and the New York University postdoctoral program in psychoanalysis. And he's joint editor-in-chief of Psychoanalytic Dialogues. Thanks for joining us, Stephen. I'm just wondering, as way of introduction, what you hope for Mind in Mind.
Well, thank you. I'm so pleased to be involved. And I echo Graham in thanking Jane and also Laura May Brown. Jane's tireless and creative energy. I would echo a great deal of what Graham said. I think when I first learned about Mind to Mind, I think it was oriented around preserving and promoting and disseminating the wonderful traditional wisdom in the child psychotherapy field, which I will say, coming from America, is developed so extensively and profoundly in Britain. That would have been enough, I think. But the movement that we've seen and that I think Jane has led is to open the possibility of a site for linkage between the traditional and the current in a way which can be really very vitalizing. I think we have a unique opportunity here to affirm our tradition. It's clear in what's already there, and at the same time to let it percolate its way into the present and the future with the what's good in the new. For example, trauma studies, the best of developmental neuroscience, new views in psychoanalysis, without being overwhelmed by all the faddishness that overtakes us. So I think I look forward, everything Graham said, and of course Jane said, is vital. Look forward to the excitement of the interchange, but also an opportunity to be rigorous and thoughtful about what we do as we do that. I think it's also great that we're online. I think that so many of us in the generation that didn't grow up with these kinds of media, have watched from the outside as the world changed. And I feel actually personally very lucky and excited to be involved in an environment which enters the 21st century in this full way, at the same time that the traditions on the page and in the consulting room are honored and present. So I thank you, everyone, for your involvement.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks very much. And Laura May Brown is on our board too. I'd like to introduce you to her. She's been really fundamental to getting this project off the ground. Laura May is a wellbeing practitioner and trainee psychodynamic psychotherapist, and she's the creative director of Mind in Mind. So welcome, Laura. Thank you.
Thank you.
What do you have? You're a trainee psychodynamic psychotherapist, and I think it was really good to have you on board, because I think it's important to get the next generation working with children to get their perspective. What do you hope for Mind in Mind?
Yes, absolutely. I really hope that Mind in Mind can be an accessible resource for trainees like myself, a site that can enhance and support our learning. I know as a trainee it can feel a little overwhelming going into the psychodynamic world, and just to have a resource there that really feels accessible, I think that's the main thing, and engaging as well. It's a real pleasure to be involved with all these wise minds, and thank you so much, everyone, for joining. It's great to see you all.
Well, Laura, you're making it really accessible by some of the lovely touches that you're putting into our video, so thanks for that. And last but not least is Shivani Lamba. She's an incredible young woman. She's a software engineer creative technologist and the founder and CEO of Brightlobe, which creates innovative technology and games for children's well-being. I was delighted when Shivani agreed to join the board, as she's such an innovative creator. Shivani, welcome. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you so much, Jane.
What are you hoping for in Mind in Mind?
The thing that honestly excites me the most is this concept of interdisciplinary knowledge sharing. And I think in doing that, we have a tremendous opportunity to bring together sort of all types of people from all walks of life, but also within the community. So celebrated leading lights to professionals very early in their careers, like Laura mentioned. And at launch, what's so incredible is that the website is already brimming with content. So interviews and podcasts, like you just mentioned, Jane, thought pieces. And I know that over time, this community will continue to grow and evolve. And I'm incredibly humbled to be part of this team, but I know that this vision that we share isn't ours alone. I know that all of us here at this event really share this vision. So what I'm really looking forward to is the contributions from this community. I'd really love to see that on the platform, and I think that's exactly what's going to give it the traction that it deserves. So that's what excites me.
Thank you. I love your call for action. I agree. I think it's the contributions of the community that I think are going to be really vital for sort of seeing Mind in Mind grow and evolve and become a really, really important and useful resource. So thank you, board members. With no further ado, I want to come to our star guest this evening, Gianna Palacco-Williams. She's a consultant child psychotherapist and psychoanalyst, and is one of the most respected, incisive clinicians in child mental health today. This is her 50th year, 50th anniversary working at the Tavistock Clinic, where she led the child psychotherapy discipline in the adolescent department. She's a prolific writer and has been instrumental in establishing child psychotherapy trainings in her native country, Italy, and also in Turkey, France, and Latin America. But before we discuss her seminal paper, Doubly Deprived, it's about child deprivation in particular that we're going to be focusing on this evening. I want to say that there are many, many child psychotherapists joining us this evening who have said to me what an impact Gianna has had on their thinking and on their work. I know that Nick Waggett, who's the chief executive of the Association of Child Psychotherapists, is joining us this evening. Nick, if you could unmute yourself if you can, and your video, that'd be wonderful. Because I thought it would be important to have you say a few words, because it'll be Gianna's 50th anniversary being a member of the Association of Child Psychotherapists next year. And I wondered what you think Gianna's contribution has been to child psychotherapy.
Well, thank you, Jane. That's very kind of you to ask me to say a few words and speak before Gianna and colleagues begin. Yes, I am the chief executive of the Association of Child Psychotherapists, which is the professional body for child and adolescent psychotherapy in the UK. And yes, we celebrated our 70th anniversary last year. And it is wonderful to be here this evening amongst many distinguished colleagues and members of the ACP, and, you know, of course, people from a range of other backgrounds and disciplines. I absolutely agree with what you've said, Jane, about the importance of getting this knowledge and expertise and wisdom out there, and really welcome the website as a platform to do that. yes, I mean, increasingly important and relevant. I think we're very fortunate in the UK, actually, that we've managed to secure the long-term future of child psychotherapy in the NHS and the funding of the training. Appreciate that's not necessarily the case in other parts of the world. Welcome this development and really look forward to hearing Gianna speaking and talking to colleagues. And thank you very much, basically.
Thanks very much for your contribution, Nick. appreciate it. So Jana Palaco-Williams wrote a paper in 1974 called Doubly Deprived. She was known then as Jana Henry, and it became an instant classic. And it's still one of the most quoted papers in child psychotherapy. The significance of this paper can't be underestimated. It sparked research into psychotherapy with deprived children, which brought about the publication of a book that many of you will know. It's called Psychotherapy with Severely Deprived Children, edited by Mary Boston and Rolene Shaw. Before it was published, there was a widely held belief that severely deprived children couldn't be helped with child psychotherapy. So, Jana, welcome. Thank you for agreeing to be our main guest this evening. I feel very honoured that, first of all, you gave us an interview, and then you're here this evening with us, sharing your wisdom. I'd like to hear a little bit about Martin. He was the boy that formed the basis of this paper called Doubly Deprived.
Yes, you'd like to hear?
It'd be nice to hear a little bit about him. He's really stuck in my mind, having read the paper several times.
Well, I can say something about his history, which I think is meaningful in terms of the topic of deprivation. I started seeing him when he was 14, but he had been taken into care when he was 2 months old, and his mother was never in touch with him again. And he was in 3 different children's homes up to the age of 2. And then he was fostered for quite a long time, for 10 years, in fact, by a family that tried, they had been really standing on their head to try and keep him as a foster child, but at some point gave him up and found him unmanageable. And this was before I started seeing him. And he had actually, when he was 12 and was still in fostering, attempted suicide by trying to jump from a second floor window. It was stopped, but I think that might have had an impact on the foster parents, one of the reasons why they felt they couldn't cope. Anyhow, I will go later into how they felt about the separation, how Martin felt about the separation. Now, just talking about Martin, and I don't generally think that, a person is defined by his or her history, but as we are focusing on deprivation, I just thought it would be important to say where Martin came from. He's a middle-aged man now. I think that because I started seeing him in 1972, in fact, then the end of 71, beginning of 72, and then the paper is only about the beginning of his treatment, because then I continued to see him quite a long time.
His appearance was quite distinctive, wasn't it, Jana? I think the way you described him in the paper, having these sort of an interesting combination of quite aggressive, stereotypical male traits and feminine traits. You said he wore knuckle dusters, didn't he, on his fingers, but he also sometimes painted his nails as well.
Well, I think perhaps I should say something about one of the reasons for referrals, and that was that he flicked knives open in school, and he terrified children by putting knives, under their chin. He had never actually hurt anybody. I will talk later, if we have time, about his selection of children to terrify. But that side, the knuckle dusters and the knives and so on, had a very aggressive but brutal quality. And I think that there is one aspect of him that is very puzzling, because as I described in the paper, there was also something in him that was somehow identified with somebody he had in his mind, as there isn't any evidence actually that he had had the experience of a mother was more interested of the reflection of her face in the mirror than about a child trying to get her attention. But that is what he put across, because knuckle dusters on his hand, he, for instance, would, on one occasion, he had one of those parkas, this fur head hood, and he would take a comb out of his pocket, and I've seen him using the comb quite a lot in the session, and then he would comb the fur round his hood in a sort of very languid and sensual gesture, and very feminine gesture. And he had knuckle dusters, and at times, but that was very, very brief, the painted nails. And it was interesting to try to figure out what he was putting across, what he was trying to tell me. And something that has been important with Martin, but has continued to be absolutely central in my way of working, is that I think that what a patient makes me feel could look like an attack, but has also got an aspect that is a communication, and the communication is very important and to be taken seriously. So what did Martin make me feel like when he was looking quite disinterested in what I was going to say? He would use his sunglasses as a mirror. And so he would look in the sunglasses while he was going through the sort of admiration of himself. And in the meanwhile, if I tried to talk with him, he would say, "I've got no time for your rubbish," or "Tough, you've got to suffer. You're a dustbin stuffed with rubbish, and dustbins don't talk." That wasn't very pastel color. You see, he was wearing at time pastel color t-shirts, and there might have been something feminine in the way he combed his hair, but he was a mixture of really very, very many facets. Mm-hmm. And I came to understand, and here I was also helped by supervision, that what I was experiencing was an important message. What did I feel like? I really felt like a child who is trying to get the attention of somebody who's got no time to listen. "I've got no time for your rubbish." So was perhaps Martin putting something that was very, very painful into me, this feeling that there was, it was not at all interesting, you know, that there was much more interest in this person who was identified with, because he entered into this identification inside his anorak and his hood, was some sort of narcissistic, full of herself type of object who had no time for him.
Yeah.
And it took really quite a long time, and a long time of being called the dustbin and being told the tough you've got to suffer. I mean, it's not as if, you know, overnight I could make use of what Martin made me feel. And I also think that when something painful is conveyed in this way, because the patient makes you feel it, you haven't got to sort of play table tennis and, you know, give back this projection in a very immediate way. I think that you have to metabolize it, you've got to keep it and understand it, and then cautiously attempt to say something like, "And maybe you like for me to know how it feels to be a child who's talking with somebody who's got no time to to listen. And he had also told me, you're talking to a brick wall. And I said, you know, no time to listen. And it was very hard also, like a brick wall.
So some people might like to sort of hear, why doubly deprived?
Doubly deprived, I think, could be described, for instance, by something in his history. When he left the foster home, the parents were very distressed, the foster parents. They had a son of their own. He didn't want to have anything to do with Martin because he had hurt his parents too much. But they tried to visit, and when they visit the children's home, Martin had no time for them at all, and he looked perfectly settled, and it didn't give them the feeling he was missing them at all. When the foster mother had phoned him, had spoken with him on the phone, she had to stop the telephone call because she was crying too much, but Martin seemed quite indifferent. So after the visit to the children's home and feeling they didn't matter, they gave up. And later they were retrieved, but in fact they gave up, they didn't get in touch with Martin. So that in a way, Martin being a brick wall, being hard, had hardened them. And this, I think, in Martin's life happened many times, that he created the situation where he hardened people, he got in touch, I mean, were in touch with him, with this slogan, something he repeated many times to me, I don't miss anybody, people miss me. And I think that this gives an example that this identification with this hard and also vain, narcissistic object, character, person in his head, and I insist in his head, not the photocopy or the clone of anything external, I think that had an impact, the defense that he had developed in order not to feel psychic pain, exposed him to a series of losses because people just became hard themselves. And then those experiences mm-hmm. cemented the hardness of this image within him. And it was a vicious circle.
So Joanna, the first deprivation is the one that's inflicted on him by external circumstances, isn't it? And over which he had absolutely no control. And then the second deprivation is from the internal sources. So these crippling defenses.
Yes, I think you made very clear. I hadn't really answered your question about why double. Double because there is one factual deprivation and you can do nothing about it. Mm-hmm. But I think that what can make one feel hopeful is that the second deprivation is not there to stay necessarily. That something can be done about it. And, you know, it was in the work with Martin that I developed this hope that it is really possible to change the quality of the internal world. That I obviously basing what I'm talking about on hypotheses that I find useful. And I think in this podcast, probably, there will be other hypotheses that will be formulated. And I don't think, I mean, I studied philosophy before I became an analyst and child psychotherapist. And what I've learned from philosophy, what that remained with me, is that there is no truth with a capital T. Because by approaching many ways of finding meaning, I didn't feel that there was, you know, the true way. And this influences also my approach to theories and ideas. I don't think that there is a true one, but for a number of reasons, we are attracted to hypotheses that to us seem more useful and that we can use better in our work. So the one I'm using is that I think that our dreams come from a place that I would call an internal world, an internal landscape. And that there are lots of tenants in this internal landscape. And some are very useful and some are quite damaging. And they can be changed. That object can come back to life in the internal world, but they can't in the external one.
Thank you, Jana. I think that's really interesting. And I'd like to bring in Ricky here to talk about triple deprivation, and then you two can speak together about this. Ricky Emmanuel is a child and adult psychotherapist. He perhaps more than anyone has impacted on the provision of child adolescent mental health services in London. For nearly 30 years, he worked at the Royal Free Hospital as head of child psychotherapy. Ricky isn't afraid of challenging the status quo. He's a rare breed, a practicing clinician who has been willing to take on leadership roles in the state sector. As clinical lead for the Camden Primary Care Trust, he led a complete dismantling of child mental health services, challenging established systems of mental health provision, and in doing so, meeting with quite a bit of resistance. But he wanted to really bring parity to children living in deprived areas of the borough. So I've asked you, Ricky, to join our discussion this evening because of your background shaping clinical services for deprived children, and also because of your late wife's contribution to our understanding of child deprivation. Louise Emmanuel was a child psychotherapist at the Tavistock Clinic, where she led the under five service. Louise very tragically died in 2017. But one of her most well-known papers is Triple Deprivation, written after she set up a therapeutic service for looked after children in a social services department. She found that these children suffered from an additional deprivation on top of the double deprivation that Jana has described. And it's brought about by organisational difficulties. She wrote about how the disturbing emotional states of these children get reenacted in the system, leading to a paralysis or drift, which she called triple deprivation. Ricky, I'd be interested to hear your perspective on what Jana's been talking about in double deprivation and Louise's contribution to the thinking in terms of her writing about triple deprivation.
Thank you for asking me, Jane. It's a pleasure to be here. Jana's work is influenced all of us. I mean, she had a major influence and continues to have an influence on my development right throughout the child training and the adult training under the Tavistock. But and many of her concepts we use in everyday language now, not even people really realizing that they come from her. I mean, today I was using one, not just because we're going to speak to Jana tonight, but her mother was asking me how to talk to her child about the fact that one of her friends made a very, very serious suicide attempt and is in ITU and very likely will die. And the thoughts that come to my mind very quickly in that are Jana's thoughts about self-harm and object harm. That's such a kind of a central idea where she sort of changed thinking around the idea of a sort of suicide attempt as an attack on the self, and really looking about it. And I know other writers have done as well, but her particular way of being able to frame it in such sort of pithy language to talk about object harm, and it's something more akin to murder by one of these tenants that she's just talked about. And one of the tenants might be trying to murder another tenant, and that kind of way, or convicts' containers with a spout and no entry. I mean, there's so many of her concepts, but you've asked me particularly to really speak on behalf of Louise and the impact Jana had on Louise, which was also huge and formidable. So she wrote this paper in the 1990s called Triple Deprivation, based on her work in a social services department where she was supposed to set up a psychotherapy service to give these very deprived children long-term psychotherapy. She quickly found that that was often impossible to do because of the difficulties in the system, and that it wasn't really what was required. And that she found that Jana's idea of double deprivation very much translated into what kind of deprivation, and you mentioned in your introduction, Jane, these children suffered at the hands of social workers, of organizational structures that they were faced with. And she looked into that and came up with this idea of triple deprivation, in a very, very similar kind of frame that Jana's talking about, but not just in an individual context, but in an organizational context. I suppose what she introduced, which was new in this and took some of Jana's thinking a little bit further on that, was bringing in a lot of attachment theory, and particularly the attachment theory about disorganized attachments. I know I saw in the little people who heard Sebastian Kramer's here today, and he was at the Tavistock when I was training too, and he, I don't know, did a lot of work on the enactments within the social services departments of the systems that are existing within these networks of people trying to look after children. But it was this idea of this disorganized attachment and how that gave rise to some of the aspects of the double deprivation as it manifested in the deprivation that these children had from their social workers or their link workers or the social work managers, particularly in the area Jana's just addressed, where this Jana was of a kind and in the setting where she could receive the projective identifications of Martin. She had a space to think about those projective identifications. She could make sense of them and give meaning to some of that behavior. Unfortunately, many foster carers, many birth parents, many link workers, social work managers are also on the receiving end of a massive amount of projection into them from their clients, from the birth mother, from the foster parents, and so on. And that often in response to the these projections, which they can't make sense of in the sense that there's no thinking space in the way that Jana provided thinking space for Martin, they shut down. They shut down because the way that they're treated by these people is so full of confusing messages of sort of wanting these kind of service and then at the same time being very hostile to the service that's being offered. Yeah. I can't go into too much detail, but noticing the kind of sorry, Jane, you want to say something?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to ask you, I mean, it feels particularly relevant, triple deprivation, which is why I wanted to have you speak about it, Ricky, because, you know, we know that an awful lot of families that we're working with who've got social services involvement, that they're not seeing social workers anymore. So, you know, there's a lot of children who are very vulnerable, were very vulnerable anyway, and they've not even been cited by their social workers. I'm thinking about a few families that I'm involved with that, you know, because of the pandemic, social workers haven't been able to go into their homes. And Louise, I thought, you know, she sort of described the problem, but I really like the fact that she came up with a sort of a partial solution in terms of the need for a secure base for social workers and their managers, and to have a reflective space that they can think about the work in the way that we do as therapists.
Exactly. So it's transferring some of the ideas that came out in the individual setting, which Jana was talking about, into an institutional setting to provide the secure base, which is a thinking space, a place where projections can be thought about, where they can be metabolized, another word that Jana often uses, and made sense of, rather than just enacted, and therefore that and causing defenses to be set up in the very people that you need the help from, hence triple deprivation. So I think the thinking space is crucial.
Thanks for that, Ricky. I think that's one thing that I think we on the board, editorial board, really, really want Mind in Mind to extend this thinking to professions like social workers. So any ideas about how we do that from our audience would be really, really welcomed. Thanks, Ricky. I wanted to bring in Stephen Seligman here. I really enjoyed your paper you wrote about your work using Selma Freiberg's model of infant parent psychotherapy. I think you trained with Selma for a while, didn't you? And what you describe as the bureaucratic transference that resonates with what Ricky's been talking about in triple deprivation. Is Stephen with us? I think Stephen's...
I'm unmuted now.
Oh, yeah. Did you hear what I said?
What did you say?
So I introduced you and said that you wrote a paper using Selma Freiberg's model of infant psychotherapy, and you described bureaucratic transference. That sounds has some similarities with triple deprivation. I wondered what that was.
Yes, well, yes, thank you. I worked for many, many years at the Infant Parent Program, which was the program that Selma Freiberg started to implement her idea that parents would transfer their own trauma to their children, especially to their babies, as a matter of as the basis for a psychoanalytically oriented intervention. And I think that in the course of doing that work, our group became much more aware of the extent to which the conditions of the exact conditions that Ricky described were reproduced intergenerationally, and in each case I recall many cases in which our intervention was viewed by the families that we were trying to help, the parents, as if it were the punitive and intrusive effort by the government to control them. In addition, we worked very often with African American families and Latinx families, and there again, there was the feeling was that we became assimilated to the social structures and those social patterns, no matter what our intentions were. And initially it was tempting, of course, to think of that as a rather personal matter, and to think of it in the usual terms that have been so helpful in describing the intrapsychic. But it did seem over time that it was not only that, but it was actually a matter, if you like, of the both intergenerational and in the moment transference, if you like, of the experience that our clients were having with the kinds of social systems that in certain ways were quite inadequate to the task of supporting them. And that were often in some way neglectful and persecutory. I say that, I think, again, echoing what Jana said and what Ricky said, with the greatest interest in supporting the efforts of the social workers and the child protective workers. Their working conditions are much more trying, I believe, than ours. They're overwhelming. They're first on the line when it comes to experiencing the rawness of the trauma, of the abuse, of the deprivation, and they face situations in which they're under-supported economically, bureaucratically, and psychologically. So I don't mean in any way to be critical of the individuals, but I think we came to, and it was in light of that that I found myself extending the idea of institutional transference to speak about the way that bureaucracy became a matter of, if you like, the internal object world that Gianna painted so beautifully. And that indeed it had an intergenerational effect. We came to see many parents whose children were in foster care in our hope to secure reunification, who themselves had been in foster care. And of course, that's a common. So that was that kind of thing. If I could, I'd like to mention a couple of other themes that I've learned about as I've listened, if I have a moment.
Yeah, if you briefly, Stephen, because I'd like to include our audience as well.
Oh of course.
I want to just get Graham Music's perspective too.
I think I've used my 5 minutes, but I can't resist making a list of some of those remarkable areas that Gianna touches on in the paper. On double deprivation, which make it so rich. Psychosis as defense rather than primary psychosis post-traumatically. The complex relation between psychosis and deprivation and the appearance of psychosis. I think she opens a discussion to which we might find quite rich at some time in the future between deprivation, trauma, and gender and gender identification and gender identification and gender identity as defense and communication. Last two other things I just will mention before closing. The whole matter of the appearance of sociopathy and a kind of almost, forgive me for paraphrasing you, Jana, pseudo-sociopathy, if you like, in a certain sense. And finally, most movingly, the capacity of the committed therapist to sustain hope and to interpret hope rather than to interpret destructiveness. I thank you all for the opportunity to speak here.
Thank you, Stephen. I like that addition there about hope, maintaining hope, and how important that is. Graham, just briefly, and you might just want to say a couple of words, Jana, before we open up the discussion to our audience. Graham's going to be monitoring the chat, but before you do that, I was wondering what your perspectives are, on the impact that Jana's had on your thinking.
Well, I think it's been huge, and I think this paper is absolutely seminal. And most of my working life as a therapist with adults and kids has been with kids, particularly kids who've been in the care system, and or who have been in the care system in the past. And so the idea of this double deprivation, time and time again, I see kids who, you see well-meaning teachers and social workers who get their care thrown back in their face, and they are so helped by the idea that actually they're not being seen for who they are, but something is going on in the internal world of the child. And I also want to say that something about Gianna's not only has she got a capacious capacity for containment, as Ricky said, an extraordinary capacity to metabolize complex experiences and painful ones. She doesn't brook, you know, there's nothing sentimental, but she's got extraordinary compassion within that. And I first witnessed that when I first arrived at the Tavistock for an interview for the observation course. And in my own double deprivation was, I'm sure I'll be rejected, I'm sure she'll hate me. And of course, Jana somehow managed not to be fooled into the triple deprivation and saw a little bit of potential, enough to allow me onto the course, at least, for which I'm forever grateful. And also, you know, one of my big regrets is that she invited me onto into the adolescent department when I first started training, and I couldn't join because I had a full-time job somewhere else. But I want to say a few words about why I think this is such an important concept in so many different ways, and also how we might link it to some other thinking. I'll be quick, Jane. But so one of my interests is in the area of emotional neglect. And one of the things I find with kids who've come from backgrounds of neglect is that Gianna would say they make us feel very, very shut down. But I think certainly in their presence, we feel very shut down and very deadened. And then it's very hard to be alive. They've got a very dead internal object. Anna Vries would say that's what we have to kind of enliven. And part of our job is to bear and really know that deadness. And I'm not sure it's always projection. I think sometimes it is. And sometimes it's, as Joe Sandler once said, sometimes it isn't projective identification. Sometimes it's a kind of resonance. And the triple deprivation, which I think is so stunning, is that so often with these cases, whenever there's a chance to discuss them, for example, in a team meeting, the whole room goes dead and flat. And these cases don't get thought about. They don't have lively minds about them. We move on to the complex acting out ones. And so there's something about this triple deprivation that gets it out into the system. And I think what's fascinating, I think in relation to the future of mind in mind, is we can link this if we want to, you don't have to, with, for example, some of the neurobiology, that something happens. We know what happens in the neurotransmitter hormonal systems, where there's low dopamine and low serotonin. We know that if you're in the presence of somebody with an avoidant attachment, you tend to then go off and be less interested in the next three or four people you interact with. So we can make links between these concepts, both in terms of the internal world, external world, and the neurobiology. And there's no end of fascinating learning from this paper. So I'd really, really recommend it. And before, I'm not sure if you want me to do this, Jane, but first of all, just I have a huge debt of gratitude to you, Gianna, and to Ricky, who I was one of his minions in Camden PCT, where we got service into every single school. And Louise's paper has been stunning in terms of helping the professionals, particularly in schools, I think. I've had an email from Valerie. Would you like me to read it out about Gianna?
Okay.
Okay, so Valerie Villatinison was hoping... Valerie Sinison was hoping to be here, but she couldn't be here, Gianna. And so she's written, "It was a privilege to train as a child psychotherapist in the adolescent department of the Tavistock Clinic and to have the creative benefit of Gianna as a teacher. Her warmth, humour, passionate love of psychoanalytic thinking and generosity made a big impact on all of us. She didn't infantilise her students or want compliance and appreciated us developing our own creative minds. Among many other things, I loved her paper on double deprivation, where she looked at the external attack, which was real, and then the internal response when it was negative. It was so compassionate. She also brought us the Italian connection and a wider view of theory, and I have to say, was so intrinsically glamorous too. And if I can add also, Gianna never had a party at the Tavistock or a celebration without there being dancing. And I'll hand over now. Thank you.
It's sad we can't do some dancing this evening. That would have been good. Thanks, Graham. I want to open it up. I think the way you do it is, I think you can raise a hand or you can type something in the chat function. But before, so just to give you a bit of time to chat or to raise a hand, I know there's some people here who've joined us this evening who I have interviewed. Their interviews are going to be going up in the next few weeks. I think Anne Horn has just had to leave. I wanted to include her. Jean Magania is joining us. I don't know whether, Jean, you want to say something. I know that Iska Wittenberg is here. Amazing, Iska. You managed to get onto Zoom, and I'm absolutely delighted that you're here. Do you want to say anything, Iska? You need to unmute yourself. Iska will have to unmute. Oh, there we are.
But I could talk about a case I've seen in which the loss is, and the deprivation is, if you like, very ordinary thing, but one that people don't think about. Yeah. And my subject all has been for quite a while on endings in life, and so I'm talking about losses. I don't know whether it's only about deprivation we want to talk tonight.
Well, I think many of us here will join in thanking you, Iska, for the huge contribution that you've made to child psychotherapy. I think you might be in your seventh or eighth decade working as a child psychotherapist. It's really, really quite incredible. And the thinking on education as well, sort of how the effect of deprivation on children's educational success or otherwise, that you wrote with Jana. I think your contribution on loss and endings has been phenomenal. Thank you so much for that. I'm sure many of us would chime with me thanking you for that. Would anybody else like to contribute to the discussion here this evening? I'd be very welcome you'd be very welcome to join in.
Do feel free to, so I think Lydia might want to say something actually.
Yes, I do. I read Jana's paper years and years ago when she wrote it. And what I took from it and the way I understood it, and not sure if I misunderstood it, is that in fact the child who is deprived unconsciously feels responsible for their rejection by the parent, so that in a way, when somebody offers something, a good object, when somebody offers care and love, they don't feel they deserve it, and therefore they can't use it. It's as if being the love is a form of intimacy, which they have to somehow reject.
I think that's really interesting, Lydia. Jana, have you got anything to say in response to that?
Well, I think that there is something I would absolutely agree with. I don't know about the child feeling that he has been abandoned because he's bad. I don't think that I found it as a recurrent aspect. I worked a lot also with street children in Mexico, not with them, but with educators of street children. And many of them were, in fact, thrown out of the house. And I don't think that from the work with the educadores, I got the feeling that they felt that necessarily they deserved it. What I think I would totally agree with is the fear of opening oneself to hope. That is, that if you don't trust anybody, you are not going to be disappointed. And I think that the threshold that is extremely difficult for deprived children to get over is the one of beginning to put their trust into somebody and to gamble the possibility of becoming attached to somebody. And I think in this respect, I think that there is something I would totally agree with, but I think there are plenty of agreement and disagreement.
Thanks, Jana. Would anybody else like to say something?
Yes. Monica.
Ah, Monica. Is that Monica?
Can you unmute yourself, yeah?
Okay, yeah. I suppose that what I really wanted to draw attention to is how for many years before, particularly the book was written that you referred to, there was really a sense that we could not help these children. And what I think is really very moving that many, many of these children have been helped through psychotherapy and that we have found areas of hope, and particularly by picking up the little tiny new shoots of growth that we see and helping those to grow, we have actually managed to significantly change the lives of many of these children and their families. I mean, never will those awful experiences that they've had early on in life go, but I think the families and the children who benefited from the vast, you know, so many child psychotherapists are working with these sorts of children now, and we have found some sort of hope. And I think a lot of that comes from the depth of our training, the importance of our analysis, our capacity to contain these very distressing feelings and experiences and to keep on going with it. So I suppose I wanted to enlarge a bit on the idea of hope and how we actually have managed what certainly, from what I understand, in the 60s and after that, would have been thought to be quite impossible. So, and I think it's also very important, the other point I wanted to make about Mind in Mind is that I think it is so timely in these COVID times that ideas and thinking about child mental health is out there in this way. There is such an enormous need. And I think so many of us are very concerned about the impact this has had on ordinary child and adolescent mental health, but also obviously on our patients as well. So I congratulate you on what you've managed to do.
Thank you, Monica. Does anybody else like to, would anybody else like to contribute?
Yes. Lydia,
is it?
Talking about Mind in Mind, is this, I mean, this is a marvelous project that you've set up. Is it meant for professionals only, or is it somehow meant for the general public, or how what I'm concerned about, what I'm thinking more and more about now, that in some ways we really need to pay more attention to how we disseminate our thinking to the broader public, to people who actually work with children, in order to give them some understanding of why children behave the way they do, or why adults behave the way they do, and how we can promote this. And would your Mind in Mind be one of the platforms through which one could promote it? I mean, particularly people like social workers and teachers.
Yeah, I mean, this is... we've been talking quite a bit about, I agree, Lydia, we've been talking quite a bit about social workers and other professions that we work with. I run the counselling service in a school. And it's really important that this sort of thinking is known about in school settings. I think the aim of Mind in Mind is to get the thinking out to all sorts of professions who are working with children. That's mm-hmm. the eventual aim. For the moment, we're targeting people who are working therapeutically with children. I think we need to establish a core base there.
I want to say something.
Go ahead, Lydia.
I want to say something.
Go ahead, Lydia.
No, it wasn't me.
That's Iska. And also, Judith, I want to point out that Judith Edwards is also waiting to speak.
Yeah, and I think Jim Maganya. So shall we go with Iska first, and then come to Judith, and then Jim Maganya.
I had hoped it would be a program also for parents.
Yes. So
to understand that, children.
So I think it would be in 2021. What we're hoping to do is offer seminars to parents about key issues. So you know, we do an awful lot of effective work with parents, and I think to be able to extend but child psychotherapists are not very common in lots of parts of the country. There aren't enough child psychotherapists. There aren't enough people who are available to work with parents whose children are in distress. So we'd like to be able to offer some training and webinars to parents online. So that's a sort of a name looking forward. I think I said after Iska, was it Judith Edwards? Judith, do you want to say something?
Yes, I'm sorry I'm on Andrew Baldwin. It's just because I'm very technologically inept. My husband did it for me. I just want to say, you know, thank you so much for organising this. This is really an astonishing thing and hopefully the beginning of something much greater. I'd like to talk about something which is also deprivation, which I learnt from Juliet, who's sitting there, the idea of too good mothering. And that actually, when a child is deprived and not able to actually locate people in the outside world, Winnicott called that something worse than castration. And so I think that's something also that we need to think about, that sustaining hope is about finding better objects and actually separating from an object that's overwhelming.
Thanks, Judith. Yes. We've got an interview with Juliet Hopkins. She's wonderful. And I think that concept is really important, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
And Jean Maganya, we've interviewed Jean as well.
Well, interestingly, the conversations moved in the direction I wanted to go, which was parents, because I'm working with people in various settings where they have so few resources that the children may be seen, but the parents are, I'm just quite frankly, neglected. And I'm thinking, you know, the parents, and thinking of Louise's parent paper, the parents are very deprived of understanding
right. The
projections of their children, and particularly in adoption and fostering, one sees this. And I think because we're talking about the individual child so much, we may not have given enough importance to the beauty of parents' groups when we're completely understaffed. And I think my experience in 20 years in two different institutions is that the parents really appreciated building a community among a group of parents and finding ways of supporting each other, and even have continued after 20 years helping other parents. So I just think we need to be thinking of something besides as accompanying our individual child in therapy, something that's more community developing. And that might be, you know, what when you do your parent talks, of thinking about how parents become a little community around their children.
I think that's a great idea, Jean. And I know I was really inspired by your work with parents. I think, was it a project in Italy where you
yes.
a group of parents in a nursery
yes.
become observers of their infants? So you translated infant observation to make it accessible for parents.
And they loved it. They absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I love that. And I think to be able to disseminate just that, I think would be absolutely yeah. wonderful, to be able to allow parents to be able to observe their children and take in their children. I think that would be really...
Well, that's starting, as Sebastian Kramer said, you know, politics begin in the nursery. That's mm-hmm. starting with the parents when their baby is conceived and working with those parents in the nurseries. That's the preventative health step that we could be taking by donating an hour to a nursery every week.
So I'm conscious of time. I want us to end on time because I know you've all got an evening to go to, and maybe dinner or just to relax a bit after a hard day's work, perhaps. So just one more, I wanted to just take one more. I think did Shivani say here, there's a couple of points that are being made. Ben Collins is saying that coming from the HIV activism world, living in two pandemics, COVID and AIDS, it's fascinating to hear your language and ours describing very similar situations in clients and carers with different language. And so it's helpful to have this space, your project, to consider these issues. Thank you, Ben, for your work with people suffering with HIV, particularly in Eastern Europe, I think has been really quite very impactful and very important, a sort of a marginalised section of the community there. Thank you for sharing that. I know Maria Monzo raised a hand, and then I want to extend the discussion just to be thinking about, I know that we have been talking a little bit about where we could go with Mind in Mind, and I just want to give a little bit more, just maybe 2 or 3 minutes to that. But Maria, do you still want to say something?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you, but you haven't got your camera switched on.
Okay, all right, let me see. I have to speak. I don't know how to switch the camera on. Anyway, if I can find myself again. There we are.
That's fine.
Can you see me? No.
No, we can't, but it's fine. You can just speak and we can hear you.
You can see my mountains. Just briefly, talking about hope and working with parents. I worked with a trainee some 25 years ago in a CAMHS clinic in Hertfordshire. We saw a very deprived child. I was working with the parents, and she saw the child intensively. It was her training case, and it did quite well, and then the family left, etc. And 25 years later, last week, mom managed to get hold of me again, and she asked for a few sessions with me because she needed some help with her by now 4 children and the difficult husband, etc. So it's very interesting how the work stayed with her, and she went through some difficulties to get hold of me because she didn't have my number. Anyway, she did, and I saw her on Zoom for the first time today, and it was quite moving somehow. That's all. Hope.
Yeah. Sebastian Kramer left a message about hope being fundamental, and saying the capacity to keep on going with it, as Monica says. Yeah, you're right. I think that's a very positive note, actually, to end our discussion this evening about the importance of maintaining hope, especially in the face of such despair and difficulty that many of us are seeing during this pandemic. So before we close, we've got 5 minutes. I just wanted to just open up discussion a little bit. I suppose this is the call for action. We really would like your ideas for interviews and blogs moving forward, and also about the latest research that you know about in child mental health. So please do get in touch. If you go to the website, there's a contact form. We'd really like to hear from you. And also, I'd really like to hear from people who are interested in getting involved in the website. We need volunteers who are willing to do some research for us, to listen to interviews, to make to make some suggestions about research questions for interviews. People who'd like to do perhaps transcriptions of interviews, that's going to be really important to have the transcripts of interviews on the website. And we also need people with video editing experience, and if there's anybody out there with marketing and social media experience, we'd be very, very pleased to hear from you. But just moving forward for the next couple of minutes, parenting has come up as an idea that we really should be thinking about in terms of Mind in Mind. Are there any other areas that you think that might be really valuable in terms of serving people working therapeutically with children? Has anybody got any other ideas? Maybe not. Okay. Maybe we've been ideated out.
Jean wants to say something.
No, I think, Jane, you know about this, which is that the school, as a base for enhancing mental health of children, has tremendous potential. And I think you're going into the schools and working with the staff are, you know, they're another kind of parents, as it were, for some of these children who are very deprived. So I think that would be a very important area to talk more about.
Thanks, Jean. That's an important point. Joanna Mulligan's saying, how about interviews with children who are now adults, who were children but are now adults, who've benefited from psychotherapy years ago, and in terms of what that brings to hope, benefited from the hope of their therapists. I like that, Joanna. I think that's a lovely idea. Wouldn't that be incredible if we had some interviews with people who had psychotherapy as a child and what impact that had on them? I love that. Do get in touch if you want to talk more about that with me. So just with a minute or two left to go, I want to thank Joanna Williams for talking with us this evening and sharing her wisdom. And also Ricky Emanuel, thank you so much. It's very sad that Louise can't be with us, but I'm so pleased that we could be talking about a very important addition to Joanna's theory of double deprivation. Graham Music, thank you so much. You've supported me with this project since its first inception. I really, really value your support and help with this. Thank you. And Stephen Seligman, for your support as a board member as well this evening and your insight. Thank you. And I want to say a special thank you to Laura May Brown, who's our creative director, for all the work she's done with the videos and for her input into many aspects of the website. And thank you also to Shivani Lambra for her Y support too. And lastly, I want to thank Paul Martin. I've mentioned him before, but I need to mention him again because he's been incredible. He's our web developer. He built this amazing website. He's very, very clever. He's wise. He's so supportive. And he's very patient, luckily. Thank you for your clever wizardry and making it all possible. And lastly, for all of the interviewees, some have spoken this evening. I really appreciate you giving the time to Mind in Mind. And I really hope that your legacy continues on in years to come and influencing and shaping the thinking in child psychotherapy. So thank you very much. Thank you for joining with me. I've really appreciated this opportunity of presenting Mind in Mind to you. Please do come back to the website, keep checking in with us and sending us your ideas.
Jane, can I just add that I think we should all give you a huge round of applause for what you've done, which is really quite...
Yes. We're all muted.
Oh, yeah, unmute to give applause and also again...
Everybody unmute.
Yeah, everybody unmute and give... I think we should give a round of applause to Jane. And also remember that Joanna's full interview is now on the website or as a podcast to be downloaded, because I think we've all been... I think we've been such a privilege here in Joanna, but of course we've all left slightly hungry because we like the best meals, you always want a little bit more, and there's lots more on the website to save us, so go there.
Thank you very much, Graham. Thanks all, and good evening.
Thanks to everyone who spoke and attended the launch of Mind in Mind. You can see the video of this discussion and other interviews with child psychotherapy greats such as Joanna Williams and Monica Laniardo on our website. Each week, we're adding more interviews, research and blogs on child mental health, building a rich resource to help anyone working therapeutically with children. Go to mindinmind.org.uk.